Welcome to Footnotes. If you're a dedicated listener, welcome back. If you're a new listener, we hope you enjoy your time with us. My name is Justin, and I'll be your host for today. Alongside me is Sinem, who is the Vice President of Education for the Sydney University Law Society, and my co-host. Sinem, it's lovely to have you on.
Thank you, Justin. This episode is the first of a new series this year called Why Law, which we will be releasing throughout the year. Its aim is to reinvigorate law students at Sydney Law School who may be seeking some deeper reflection about why we chose this degree in the first place. We're going to unpack different topics that may affect us as we progress through our degree, outside of uni, when we work, or which simply exist in the world as it is today. We want to reflect and talk about all the whys we can and circle back to the particular path we all have in common, the legal industry. In this series, we're going to focus on the concept of burnout. Burnout and its surrounding areas of discussion are big issues in the law school and when we enter the working world as it is right now.
We're going to be touching on points such as the concept of burnout in the 21st century working world with a focus on the legal profession and similar office environments, the dangers of a hustle mentality in our generation where students and young people feel a grave sense of urgency to engage in constant productivity, and solutions and techniques to combat the above issues from a psychological perspective. So before we begin, let me introduce the people who have been so kind with their time today and have chosen to feature on this series. We've got Jonathan Gaston from the Sydney Anxiety Disorders Practice and Madeline Smith, one of our alumna from the Sydney Law School.
Jonathan is a clinical psychologist who works in Sydney Anxiety Disorders Practice. He specialises in adult anxiety disorders and generalised anxiety disorder.
Maddie Smith was a student at Sydney Law School and completed a Master of Laws in 2019. She's currently completing a graduate program, first in the New South Wales Department of Communities and Justice and now at the New South Wales Ministry of Health. Jonathan and Maddie, welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for asking.
So, our first question is for Jonathan. Can you share with us your journey into psychology?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways my journey was quite fortuitous. I decided to take a year off after high school, a gap year, and I basically went to the sort of high school where you either did business and accounting or you did engineering. So I think I put down to do business studies or something. Oh, that's very scary in hindsight. But anyway, but it just happened that a friend of mine from school had done psychology. He was talking to me, you know, through the year, he was telling me what he was studying and that, and I'm thinking, wow, this is way more interesting and more suited to me. So luckily, just because I took that gap year, I switched my preferences to psych and then, I don't know, just ended up really loving it.
And we'll talk about this topic a little bit more later, but what has led you to this particular passion that you have for burnout?
Well, I think like a lot of people, it basically came from my own experience of it. You know, I was only 2 years out of my master's degree. I was in my first job, and at a time when I had expected to be, you know, incredibly motivated and working hard and really enjoying what I was doing, it was quite the opposite. You know, I was coming home very low energy. I didn't want to go to work. I was getting more physical illnesses. My partner had commented that I wasn't really talking positively very much anymore about my job. So, and for me, that really came to a head, like one day driving to work, I had a full-blown panic attack. The good thing, being a psychologist, I knew it was a panic attack, so it didn't turn into panic disorder. But still, I think that was the wake-up call. And I thought, well, either I'll get out of the profession, or at the very least, before I do that, I need to try to understand what's going on. And that then led me to really starting to look at the literature. I mean, this is a long way back. This is in the mid-1990s. But, you know, just starting to look at the literature and understand it. And actually, out of that, it was quite validating, but also gave me ideas to sort of start to chart a way out. So, so it was really through my own experience.
My next question is for Madeline, Maddie. What has your experience been like since graduating from Sydney Law School?
I joined a graduate program, so I did an LLB and then my LLM here as well. I went into the government graduate program. So that involves rotating around 3 different parts of the government. It's extremely broad. I was initially in the DCJ, which is the Department of Communities and Justice. And then I've moved over to the Ministry of Health at the moment, which is amazing because that was where I wanted to come to. So it has been an adjustment to full-time work, but honestly, I think a good thing for students to look forward to is the fact that I do find it to be less consistently stressful every day.
What is something you did not expect about working in the legal industry?
So I'm currently in the more primary stream of the government grad program. So I have some exposure to the legal elements of what we're doing in the ministry. But my work experience has mostly been in paralegaling beforehand and working for a barrister. So it is an interesting point of comparison. In terms of the legal industry, one thing that I hadn't expected was, honestly, like the thing that jumps to mind is the billing, the 6-minute increments that you have to track. I found that to be really surprising. I was like, okay. And one thing that I didn't expect about working in the government is probably the variance among the different parts of the government. It's very hard to describe what it's like to work in the government because it changes so much.
Yeah. Okay. And have you worked in the commercial world? And if so, how have you found working in the DCJ and the Ministry of Health in comparison?
Yeah, I did. I paralegaled for a short period of time. Bit of a story there because I pretty quickly decided I didn't like it. It is very different, and that's a very deliberate move by the government to try and create a culture focused on employee well-being. I think there's more of an emphasis on sustaining your employees across their time with you rather than burning them out and trying to make the most of them.
So, Jonathan, would you be able to explain exactly what burnout is and what causes people to develop this condition?
Sure. I mean, what I would want to do is distinguish probably between the colloquial use of the word. I mean, it is a term that's very much entered the language, so people commonly talk about feeling burnt out and burnout, and that could cause a problem because we're not always sure whether there's a shared understanding. I think people often use the term to describe more sort of exhaustion and stress. The actual concept, a lady called Christina Maslach, who really dominates this area and has for a long time, I think has a more formal model, which I think is a better understanding of the whole syndrome. So her definition, job burnout is a psychological syndrome that involves a prolonged response to stresses in the workplace. It involves a chronic strain that results from an incongruence or misfit between the worker and the job. So her original model talked about this idea that both the organisation and the individual have the potential to contribute to burnout. But what's really interesting is she's always talked about this idea of three components of burnout, which I think are really important. The first one, and by far the most common one whenever they measure these things, is something that she originally called emotional exhaustion. She now just calls exhaustion. So a state of physical, emotional, and mental exhaustion marked by lack of enthusiasm. I think this component is the one we'd all sort of probably relate to, a stress factor. Right. And when you look at the questions that measure this, I think it's very much measuring a sort of chronic stress. The next component, originally she called depersonalization, but now she calls cynicism. And that's when you start to develop a more negative, callous, or excessively detached response to other people in your workplace. That could be your clients, but it also could be to colleagues or to managers. So you start to want to detach yourself from aspects of the work. And the last one is that your sense of personal accomplishment, or what she now calls professional efficacy, starts to decline. So you actually start to doubt your sense of competence and your ability to achieve in your workplace. Now, what the literature is simply showing is that these factors do tend to develop in this order. So by far, emotional exhaustion is the most common. Anytime they survey most professions, you know, anywhere from 50% to 80% will score, you know, significant on that factor. Yeah. Right? So that's really important to remember, because then when you add in the cynicism, that will drop to about 30%. And then when you add in the personal accomplishment, most studies that use this model show that the full syndrome often only is somewhere between 8% to 13% in most professions. Okay. So that's why it's important to distinguish between, am I in a full burnout syndrome versus am I experiencing one or two components? So certainly emotional exhaustion you need to be, you know, aware of and careful with, because it is the first step. but it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to develop into a full burnout syndrome.
Yeah. I think the second component that you mentioned is very hits close to home, because cynicism is something I'm definitely experiencing right now. Right. Even in my legal profession class, every time the teacher asks anything about culture of like legal industries, like I keep, you know, saying the most negative things about it. And I feel like almost the students are looking at me like, is she okay? So definitely, I think it can permeate into everyone. From your experience as a psychologist, have you witnessed a lot of legal professionals experiencing burnout? And is there anything particularly unique about legal professionals and their experience with burnout?
What I would say is I would probably defer to you guys. I'm interested to hear Maddie talk about this. There probably are specifics within law, but I think it's more that there are factors within law profession that are risk factors across certain professions. So Maslach talked initially, in fact her model initially said that only professions that she saw as sort of helping or health or service professions could get burnout. That was her original model. Now she's changed that, which I think is good. So you can burn out in any role, but I think I would see, you know, a lot of the legal profession within that category. High workload often, a lot of client contact hours, a lot of other hours, a lot of after hours work, etc. So I think that those factors are also shared in a lot of other things, medicine, psychology, police, so these sort of service or people focused types of roles or professions are, I would see as definitely more prone to burnout risk.
I think the next few questions I'll base it on Maddie's experience. So based on what Jonathan has explained about burnout and your own understanding, do you think you have experienced this condition?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you mentioned the legal profession, because I remember we had a mid-sem assignment when I did it, and I wrote this big long essay about how I saw all these inconsistencies in what was taught in the course versus like the real life application of it all, like what was put in the solicitors and barristers' rules and awards, and then what was the reality.
Yeah.
I didn't go well. I don't recommend that as a strategy for your assignments. But yeah, I think around that time, in kind of like fourth year, fifth year, there's suddenly a lot of pressure on students, especially law students. We have like in your penultimate year or in JD2, there's a lot of pressure to get a clerkship or to secure really impressive internships, and all of a sudden this vague knowledge that you had about this need to stack your resume in different areas really comes to a head. Yeah. And suddenly I think students these days are faced with so many pressures as well, because it's no longer just about, you know, as it was half a century ago, you come to uni and that's your role and that's your focus. It's now like, sure, you need to excel in the classroom, but you should also have, you know, volunteering experience or some kind of not-for-profit involvement. You need to have really impressive work experiences in multiple ways, and be involved in student societies. You know, there's a million things. Have cool hobbies as well. Like, no one has that time in the day for all these things. And so I did feel, I think it was first semester in fourth year, I did 10 extracurricular and like other activities to try and stack my resume hard.
Is that when you were part of Souls as well?
I wasn't actually ever on the exec of Souls. Oh. Yeah, I was on subcoms, but being involved in subcoms was part of that. So yeah, I had this sudden desire to try and overcompensate for what I'd seen as like a lack of achievement relative to my peers, right? Because I was still achieving, but just you're among such incredibly talented and intelligent people that you're like, oh my god, this isn't enough, I need to go harder. So yeah, I definitely reached that point of just, I think it's also me, I have a predisposition to question myself, and I think that's not uncommon among law students and professionals, is we can have these very high standards and when we're not meeting them, we start to question ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's a bit of a divide between even just the professors in the law school. They are so astounded and shocked by the fact that we even work and study.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, I was getting kind of a bit of a lecture from a professor saying, why, just focus on your studies. You only get one chance to be a student. Just focus on it. Like, I know if you are not if you're not in that position to not work, that's so fine. But if you have that privilege to be able to not work, then focus on your studies. But it is such a cultural thing now to study and get your foot in the door, as they say. So definitely can relate to that. As someone who was in the law school not too long ago, how have you seen mental, emotional, and physical exhaustion play out amongst students and peers?
That's a good question. I think really it was rife. I actually struggled to think of any person that I met in law school who was cruising, who was having a great time, and also who, you know, was still caring and wanting to one day, you know, get a grad job out of it and that kind of thing. And I think one key factor is that everyone just kept pushing themselves. The one semester I just had to go, you know what, this was semester two of that fourth year. I was like, you know what, that's it. And I'm like quitting all these extra things. I need to just refocus on me. And that seemed like a very dangerous thing to choose.
Yeah.
You know, and I think everyone was really concerned about me. They were like, sure, I'm exhausted, but I don't see another viable option but to be exhausted because I have so much I need to do. And I think that journey, that contrast in that year helped to show me that rather than it being a binary state of like you're well or you're burned out, it really is that spectrum that people experience to a greater or lesser degree, those factors you were mentioning, Jonathan. And yeah, I think we were all kind of on the spectrum. So, and I think in a work context as well, when I was paralegaling, which only lasted about 3 months, by the way, because I quit. I was like, you know what? I don't like this and I should leave.
No, it's really respectable.
There was just a lot of very high stress over very menial tasks, right? Like when you're a paralegal, you're compiling like briefs, you're like printing stuff or doing discovery, and it's this pressure to really produce a lot, but you're not being intellectually challenged. I think that contributed to what we're all feeling. So,
yeah. Definitely. And just like we are speaking about the way in which the legal industry can be a breeding ground for burnout, do you think that university and law school can also become this too?
Yeah, increasingly so. I think so, because I think those concerns and that desire to achieve and succeed in a career is kind of being brought back and pinging upon law students earlier and earlier. You know, people are feeling the pressure to have a good law job in their second year now.
Yeah, and I think that people kind of think of themselves as like the exception to the rule rather than the other way around. So like someone has a paralegal position in their first year, people say, well, why don't I have a paralegal position in my first year? And then that kind of like, even in your second year of law school, you start thinking about ways to get your foot in the door, ways to build your experience. And in doing so, you kind of start to think inorganic thoughts, like what am I not doing right now that I need to do more of, you know, what facet of my personality is absent that needs to be filled, you know, like why aren't I getting these jobs, why, like the only solution there being is to like, you know, either radically reinvent yourself or like just consistently try to do as much as you can. And I think that's like, yes, people are, you know, exceptional, yes, people maybe, for example, even be quite lucky, but I think people treating that as like that's just how it is kind of then becomes very ingrained in how law students feel. We'll pivot now to Jonathan again. So we see a lot of workplaces talk about facets of well-being, but, you know, at times I think we can all sort of agree that it does feel a little bit superficial and more like maybe like a wet blanket over the real problems. So do you think that the current expectations of the working world cater for positive mental health at all?
Wow. Just throw the whole of the working world.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going a good direction. I mean, for example, one thing, it was great to hear you guys talking about some of those things within the profession, because one of the things that I do talk to clients a bit about, professions have what I call cognitive cultures, in the sense that they're unspoken and perhaps even unrealized, but they're embedded. And they're often, you start to be sort of drawn into that culture as soon as you start studying, right? So in psychology, for example, a lot of academics, a lot of supervisors have very unrelenting standards. They're often themselves perfectionists.
Yeah.
And so even though they might not be overtly saying to students, this is how you've got to function, I mean, you are observing. So, yeah, you know, it's being modelled and it's almost implicit, do you know what I mean? So I was thinking about that as you guys were talking about profession, that it starts early. It may not even be conscious, you know what I mean? So professions develop cultures. what I call sort of cognitive cultures, sort of almost like unconscious belief systems mm-hmm. about how you should work.
Yeah.
And I think that can be problematic. And, you know, I've had to talk to quite a lot of my clients that they may have to choose to be an outlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right? Do you know what I mean? Because, yeah. You know, it, just because everyone's implicitly participating in this culture doesn't actually say the culture's healthy. So, yes. You know, yeah. And but they it makes it harder because you've sometimes got to push against, you know, yes. the culture yeah. that you are within, and sometimes people comment on that.
Yeah.
The overall question, look, I think there is some research showing, interestingly, that probably burnout is on the rise.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's been talked about a range of levels, but one of the ones I've become interested in lately is this idea of what they're calling chronic time pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So as society, what's sort of happening is that the boundaries between work and other aspects of life are blurring further and further.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people spend a lot of the time constantly feeling time pressured, that there's more to do, that they're not getting to yeah. things. And so that may cause people to work later hours, to have their phone constantly on etc.
Yeah.
And yeah. so some of these things, some of the interesting things being looked at is why might burnout be on the rise outside of things like, you know, changes in work cultures and economic sorts of factors. But yeah, certainly this idea that the speed in which things are expected to be done
yeah.
and mm-hmm. processed
mm-hmm.
and this idea, I sort of think a constant compartmentalizing more and more of modern life. It's interesting now that people talk like about work and then leisure and exercise as if some, you know, it's like I've got to, you know, work I just burn out, then I've got to take 2 weeks off and collapse somewhere on the beach, you know what I mean, to go back,
yeah.
you know, and then I've got to put time aside to go to the gym. Yeah. But it's all interesting that nothing's, like, it's getting away from integration. So the idea I could actually get some of my leisure time at work, for example, or I could, does that make sense? Like I can see this sort of, I don't know, compartmentalization process perhaps going on more and more, and people thinking in these very separate terms. I'm not a sociologist, that's ultimately healthy, because all those things mean you've got to put time aside separately.
It feels almost unnatural as well, and right. even just the 9-to-5 working yeah. cycle, and you get a 1 hour break. Some people don't even take their 1 hour break. They mm. eat, they eat in front of their computer, and that, like,
right. yeah.
it makes me crazy.
yeah.
But yeah, definitely, I don't even know if that's natural as a human being. But
mm-hmm.
And I think there is a dominance with work in particular, because I think leisure time is increasingly, it can't intrude upon your working hours, but your working hours can intrude upon your leisure, especially in corporate
mm-hmm.
law.
Mm-hmm.
I watch
yeah.
my friends in commercial law, and they'll be out with us having dinner or drinking, and they'll
mm-hmm.
go, I've got to go. I've got
yeah.
work to do right now, because yeah. my partner emailed me, so...
Yeah, I mean, the other interesting question, someone from a different generation, I would defer to you guys, but a lot of my clients are talking about also that those other aspects of life often intrude
mm.
on work, or, mm. you know what I mean? So, being contactable, social media, texting.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
so the intrusion perhaps can go both ways
yes,
as well, in the
true.
Sense that you then feel a pressure, like, oh, I better text this person back.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I don't know. So it's this interesting... It's almost like a really hyper, there's a term out there called hyperculture, but it's this sort of constant switching
yes.
that one has to do, very fast processing,
yeah.
you know, and that there's some research showing that that is not good for mental health over time.
There is, I mean, as we talked a bit about, the perception that, you know, long hours, being readily available, you know, on call for employers and clients, and you know, even
mm-hmm.
in a more study context, losing sleep for your studies or work are all signs of being like a great employee or a great student,
mm-hmm.
because that means you're more efficient, you're more hardworking, you know, you're better with your time, you're more willing to sacrifice. So in light of that, we have sort of two prongs, which is the first one being, do you think there's going to be a world in which prioritizing your needs over work and studies becomes a social norm?
Yes. It's a good question, but it's a hard question, right? Because there's complexity with that issue. So, for example, I would say even within people's lives that they switch priorities, you know. So say you choose to have a family, like people go through a burnout process and have to reevaluate. So I think people do it. I think the other question is more difficult, which is, are at a sort of both organisational and societal level, are they going to start, you know, being more conscious of and more open to and perhaps more supportive of these sorts of ideas around burnout and so on. I don't know, it's hard to not start to get cynical about, well, how do you get change at that level? And again, I'd probably defer to you guys within the law profession. I don't know. I think you can bring about change within yourself, and you can make choices as an outlier, which is cool. So you can at least empower yourself to say, well, I don't know if I want to play along as much.
I think we'll move on to Maddie's thoughts on identity and having a job. And so as a law student, we can often allow getting a clerkship or even having a part-time job throughout our degree to become part of our identity and sense of self-worth. So did you ever struggle with this association? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, definitely. I think especially when you are coming to law school, that indicates you've previously been a really high achiever. You get into a cohort of people who are in the exact same position, and you can't rely on that previous achievement anymore. It feels like you constantly need to reassert your value. There were just all these new realms in which to compete with your cohort and to try and seek that advantage. So I think I felt, honestly, I felt quite insecure until I got that commercial job. Because I think those externally valued metrics of accomplishment just were so important to who I was. And it was a really big deal when, especially after getting that dream corporate job, each morning I went to work, I hated it. The night before I would be stressed because I wouldn't want to go to work. And I was like, surely this can't be it. Like, surely I can't value this vague sense of prestige or this, you know, vague approval from people that no one really thinks about anyway, right? And I couldn't believe that I was valuing that over my own well-being, which was clearly screaming at me, this isn't right. I definitely struggled with that association, and breaking free of that seemed honestly a bit terrifying. It was terrifying to get a HR and be like, thank you, but you should give this job to someone who really wants it, because it's not me, this isn't for me. And especially, I think at one point we said earlier that once you've sunk a lot of time and commitment into a particular career, you're like, well, I can't just give up on that.
And it's always good to, I use this a lot in my clinic, there's actually a concept called sunk costs.
The gambler's fallacy,
That's right. They're using it in psychology as well. It's the reason a lot of, one of the contributing reasons is often people stay in bad relationships as well. Like, you know, because you feel like you've got to get the payoff, right? Yeah. If you've sacrificed, you know what I mean? And so people often stay with bad decisions just to get that. So it's always a nice concept, as you said, gambler's fallacy, to remember that, it's somehow I've got to get the payoff. The more I've sacrificed.
And I'll also add as well that there's a level of like kind of almost like we sort of veil ourselves and we veil our own perception of other people to some degree. Like we sort of like cordon off our own empathy. We sort of see someone work a lot of like, you know, they work a lot. They have a really nice job and maybe like a big six firm, or, you know, they got opportunities really early, and we say to ourselves that that person is worthy of emulation without properly asking if that person is okay or not. But like, because they're in a position, at least what we all deem worthy of emulation, we sort of assume that they're grateful for that and we move on, and we want to sort of be like them with the respect of doing the exact same thing that we do. But because we don't interrogate how they're feeling or how they would or we would feel in their position, when we stumble into that first roadblock, that becomes like a huge culture shock. Like, we didn't expect this. I didn't anticipate this going to be a problem. All this adjustment, all of this, you know, like, external worry, like, oh, you know, I didn't see them worrying about this, because, you know, obviously people let on way less than actually goes on in their lives. So it feels like every problem is unique to yourself when it's actually something which is quite widespread.
And it's interesting how I've seen that modeled in my friends who did go into commercial law. And there are some friends that, because obviously everyone in my cohort's graduated and they're working now, some people, a small percentage, genuinely really love that corporate environment. They love the work. They live for it because they genuinely want it to be their life, so they're not alarmed by the fact that they're meant to be responding to a partner at 10 p.m. But for a lot of part, I think that there are many people that I've watched who they really gear up for this amazing grad job, and it's everything they were promised, and they're gonna do it, they're gonna achieve, they're gonna work hard, and they get into it with this determined mindset and this fire that they can do it. And I watched as their language changed throughout their first year of working, and how 3 months in it went from like, yeah, I'm so excited, like, I can't wait, this is amazing, to like, yeah, you know, it's a bit stressful, and you hear the tone change, you go, but you know, like I'm working through it, and I'll find a way to make myself okay with this external situation.
Yeah.
And then you wait a bit longer, and 6 months or a year, and they're going, I actually hate my working life. Like yeah. I feel I have to do it because people don't see another viable option, particularly at UCID. There is this continual corporate focus that's always been there that doesn't exist at ANU, for example.
Yeah.
ANU has a government focus because they're seated in Canberra and everyone's expected to do that after uni. And so it's really interesting what you say, Justin, because I think people don't necessarily see the problem as external. They see it as internal. I am failing to meet these standards and to be grateful and appreciative and succeeding in this role. And it's something in me as opposed to just this culture that we all need to kind of slowly go.
Yeah. That concludes part one of this podcast. For our discussion on concepts such as emotional labor, behavioral patterns, and ways to tackle burnout, be sure to check out part 2.